Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. The other day, a news story caught my eye. Claremont, New Hampshire unveiled a marker commemorating a visit to the town by the Marquis de Lafayette. Apparently, the marker is the third of its kind in New Hampshire. There are two others in Newport and Cornish, and more are planned in Derry and Hopkinton. Something about stops on his farewell tour reminded me that UVM's Green has a full-blown statue to the Marquis. I'm from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, home of Lehigh University, and their arch rival is Lafayette College, and you guessed it, named after the Marquis. And while we always rooted against Lafayette the college, Lafayette the Marquis, I was told, was someone we loved. I gave tours at the Colonial Sun Inn, and we proudly mentioned that George Washington and Lafayette had both stayed there. So who was this guy who early Americans treated like a rock star? I knew after all this it was time to call in Willard Stern Randall, Professor Emeritus of History at Champlain College, to give us a history lesson. Professor Randall, thanks for answering the call this morning.
My pleasure, Rick.
And listeners, if you'd like to ask Professor Randall about Lafayette, give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Professor Randall, with a title like Marquis de Lafayette, I'm guessing he came from a family of means. What was his background?
Well, he was from a French aristocratic and military family. His mother was something like a duchess. They owned huge amounts of land in the center of France. So when he was 13 years old, he was automatically commissioned an officer. And by the time he was 19, he was made a major general. And part of that was because he married the daughter of the admiral in charge of the French Navy. But he slipped the leash very early, shortly after his marriage, because the American Revolution had begun and he was really excited by the idea of overthrowing monarchy. So he sailed for America with a shipload of other officers and joined Washington in the Revolution.
Now, you said he was given this title, so before he came over, did he have much military training or experience there in France?
None whatsoever, no.
None.
Basically, he posing a lot in fancy uniforms with his squire next to him holding the horse. But you were born with rank in pre-revolutionary France, so he was born a marquis. That's sort of the next step down from duke.
I do love that, you know, what you're able to do, to dress in the fancy dress and pose with a horse. So, he had this idea of overthrowing, a monarchy, but, you know, why did he come to the United States? What was he offering?
Well, he was offering French support, basically. He brought other French officers with him. One was put in charge of the cavalry. Others became generals. But basically, he was offering the friendship of the French crown, the French king, to a revolution against the English king. Maybe because Lafayette's father had been killed by the English in the Seven Years' War just before he was born.
So he shows up, I don't know, you know, in 1777, now he had the title of Marquis, but could someone just show up like that and be taken seriously and brought in to help our nascent country and army?
Well, we were taking all the help we could get, and sometimes it was a problem because Benjamin Franklin was sitting over in Paris sending anybody who would show up and say he had military experience. So they had one general they sent over. Nobody wanted in Europe. He came to America. The Americans hated him so much that when he rode onto a raft with his horse at the Schuylkill River and the raft tipped over, no American would help him get out. They let him drown.
Oh my.
So a lot of these people were no good, but on the other hand, they brought with them the money and eventually the ships and the troops that helped us defeat the British.
Wow, which we were sorely in need of, correct?
Right, exactly. We weren't going to make it on our own. It was a long struggle, but without cannon and cash from the King of France, we would not have won the Revolution.
So he has this title. He has no real military experience. Was he sent into battle to fight or to lead?
Well, he volunteered as an unpaid aide-de-camp, like unpaid staff assistant to Washington. Washington had no sons, and here's this really polished, courageous young officer sort of worshiping him. So he really latched onto Washington and Washington onto him. So at the Battle of Brandywine, when the British were attacking and trying to get to Philadelphia and capture it, Lafayette actually went into battle, and he received a severe wound to his leg and still went on fighting, managed to hold the rear guard together, letting Washington and his army escape. So it was his courage that impressed Washington.
Wow, that's interesting. Was he involved in any other battles during this time?
Well, yes. He was then put in charge of troops in Rhode Island because the French Navy had come there, and he could speak French, for one thing. Mm. So he actually distinguished himself in the battle for Rhode Island before the British backed away from there. And then he was sent to Virginia after Benedict Arnold's treason. And he was in charge of American troops in Virginia, sort of holding on until Washington and the French army could get there. And he was actually in charge of the French army at the Battle of Yorktown,
the final battle. In addition to being able to speak French, he must have had some areas of expertise that really we put to good use during the Revolution. So what were his strengths?
Well, part of it is this crazy courage that these officers would have. The greater risk they took, the more heroic they were. So he would ride around on a horse and get shot at. But also, French officers were trained at a French military academy, much like West Point later was, in Paris, L'École Militaire. So they learned how to build fortifications, how to build them and how to defend them and how to tear them down. So he knew how to do that. He also understood how it worked, basically, what an army, what officers could do and what enlisted men. So basically, we had no professional soldiers. So these French came over and taught us how to do it, sort of spit polished subordination and all that stuff. But they were also crazy brave. And you know, a lot of them got killed. The head of the cavalry was killed attacking Savannah, you know. They were warriors. They were from a warrior society.
You've mentioned now they learned from the French. And when I think back of Revolutionary War, when we think of the American patriots kind of hiding behind cover and shooting that way while the British marched in formation, standing tall. I don't know if that is fact or fiction. But where does the French style of fighting at that time fall?
Fortifications, trench warfare, which they would perfect by World War One, digging trenches that went around and encircled and besieged towns and cities till they could move their cannon closer and closer and closer, which is exactly what Lafayette and the French did at Yorktown until the British had to surrender. They just couldn't hold out anymore against all this heavy artillery. So they used fortifications. Like Fort Ticonderoga was built from a design book by a French field marshal, Vauban. Mm. And these officers had this book of sort of a handbook of how to build a fort and how to besiege somebody. So Lafayette's part of that whole revolutionary crowd, where if you were born an aristocrat, you were expected also to become a military man.
Wow. So that military expertise that we were getting from the French was probably just as important as anything else during the American Revolution that helped us beat the British.
Well, I don't know if it's any even as important as all these thousands of farmers with their muskets, which couldn't hit anything beyond 100 feet, but because they were there, the rest of Europe came to join the fight. I mean, there were people from 44 different countries fighting under the American flag.
Wow. Okay, so Lafayette, we'll get back to him specifically. I think during the Revolution, then, he actually went back to France to request more support from the French king.
That's right. He went back. And he he got the help. What the French king wanted, and nobody was saying, was for Lafayette to come over with an army and navy and take Canada back from the British, which they had lost just before the Revolution. Washington was too smart for that, so he diverted Lafayette and an army to Virginia and then took most of the French troops with him to the final battle at Yorktown. So if the French had any plot, it fizzled. Mm. And that gets sort of lost in history, but they wanted Canada back, and we very much wanted them not to have it.
So was Lafayette more committed to doing the French king's bidding, or was it his own personal belief in the revolution here in the American states?
That's a tough call. Right. Lafayette became a revolutionary in America. He went back to France. He joined the movement to overthrow the monarchy in France. He helped write the French Declaration of Rights of Man along with Jefferson while Jefferson was in Paris. So I think undercover he was a dedicated revolutionary. But also I think his personal loyalty was to George Washington. So he named his first son George Washington Lafayette.
Mm. And let's take a call from Fred from Newbury. Fred, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Morning.
Morning.
It's very interesting. If I remember right, the Revolutionary War lasted 8 years. And the problem for Great Britain was the Atlantic Ocean. It was too big, too far. It cost too much money to ship troops over there. They were taking too many casualties. The king was getting sick of the war. The people were getting sick of the war. And so they quit, basically.
Willard Stern Randall, was that the what kind of really did it or undid it for the British?
Not quite. The king got sick of it after they lost two armies in two major battles. First at Saratoga, which brought the French in officially into the war as our ally, and the second at Yorktown, where the French helped the Americans finish the job. When the king heard that the Cornwallis had lost the battle at Yorktown and lost a second army, that was it. It was all over. And he said, it's all over. That was enough.
And Fred said the Revolutionary War lasted 8 years. Is that
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Lexington and Concord, the peace treaty wasn't until October, finally signed October of 1783. It was before Afghanistan. It was our longest war.
Wow. You mentioned the friendship that developed between Marquis de Lafayette and George Washington. What drew the two together?
Well, Washington admired people who were formal, for one thing. You know, he was used to dealing with people on the frontier. They didn't know discipline. They didn't care about how they looked, etc. They were there, you know, just to hold on and start something. So he had a hard time putting together an army that, you know, where officers were respected and respected themselves. And here comes this young Frenchman who knows exactly how to do all these things. And also someone who worshipped him, somebody who looked up to him, who admired him, and had left this really cushy life in Paris to come over and ride around and be in the mud and, with Washington.
Be in the mud with Washington. How long did that friendship last? You had mentioned that Lafayette named his son George Washington Lafayette.
It lasted throughout Washington's life. In fact, after the Revolution was all over, Lafayette had gone back to France, and really, he was the one who gave the weapons to the revolutionaries to take the fortress at Bastille that started the French Revolution. But in between, he came over for a visit to Mount Vernon. And spent about 6 weeks with Washington. Washington wanted to go with him out to the Ohio Valley, where Washington was having a hard time collecting rents from his tenants. And Lafayette said no. So Lafayette stayed, and he traveled around with James Madison the first time, 1784. And they stayed in touch. Once the Bastille fell, the beginning of the Revolution, Lafayette personally sent the key to it to George Washington, and it's on the wall of the dining room at Mount Vernon. It's that kind of a connection, his firstborn son after him. Lafayette was captured in the French Revolution. Washington personally sent his own money through to make sure the family was fed and sheltered, and he smuggled Lafayette's son out of France to Mount Vernon. So it's a very, very close connection that unfortunately hasn't been explored enough. Maybe I'll do that someday.
I hope so. It sounds like a fantastic story, this connection between both Washington and Lafayette. So you mentioned the French Revolution, and he had always had this kind of fire of being against the monarchy, being a kind of a revolutionary. So did Lafayette have real problems with the monarchy of France at that time?
Well, at first he joined the Estates General, which was coming up for ways to reform the monarchy, but that didn't work. By that time, he was in charge of the French National Guard, and they had all the weapons in Paris. So when the revolution broke out, he took the side of the revolutionaries and supplied the weapons, and actually was part of the first French assembly, National Assembly, a very moderate. It was too moderate. And so after a few years, as the French Revolution became a reign of terror, Lafayette himself was in trouble, and he tried to flee France, and he was captured and held in a dungeon for a few years until Washington had our ambassador there, James Monroe, spring him and get him out of France. So he'd gotten real trouble with the monarchy that time, tried to overthrow it. He succeeded. And again, at the end of his life, after his visit to Vermont, which I hope we'll have plenty of time for,
sure.
After he came to Vermont, he went back and he led another revolution against the French monarchy in 1830, which succeeded. So all his life, he wanted a republican form of government, and he wanted to be like the United States.
Why didn't he resettle here in the U.S. rather than you go back to France each time?
Well, that's a very good question, except his wife and her family were very high up in the French government. They had a wonderful mansion right on the River Seine in Paris, which you can see if you go there now. It's still there. Or you go out into the eastern part of France where they had their lands. And their castle and all that. So he would have been giving up a lot. But he still kept coming back to America. For one thing, he'd been a general, so he was entitled to several thousand acres of land in America. He could go anywhere and pick it out. And I think that had something to do with him coming to Vermont, because he was looking for prime real estate here.
Hmm. Did he ever pick out a piece of property in the States?
I wish I knew. Nobody knows yet. That takes more research. But the other thing is he lost everything in the revolution financially. They had the property. But by 1824, when now President Monroe, who had been the ambassador in Paris who got him out of prison, now President Monroe invited him to America as America's guest. Basically, he was very stylishly freeloading for an entire year in America.
Now, was this the 13-month farewell tour that he went on?
Yes, it's a farewell tour, yeah. He's a rock star by then. I mean, he was so young when he came to the revolution that now when he's 67 years old, he's one of the last revolutionary leaders that people can see. So everywhere he went, the crowds turned out, and he loved it. He would talk and talk and talk. He was late everywhere he went because he talked. He was the Hubert Humphrey of the 19th century. He was always talking and running out of time. But by the time he got to Montpelier, so late in the day, the farmers had all had to go home to milk the cows, so nobody else was there. I mean, it was like that wherever he went. But it's the 13-month tour.
And I believe he got to every or just about every state that was part of the United States at the time during this tour.
That's right. He landed in New York, where he reviewed the first New York National Guard, and then he went all over down to Washington, all through the South. Then he came back up through New England. By then it's June of 1825, and he starts crisscrossing New England, and that's how you get to Claremont, New Hampshire, on June 28th, 1825, and he crosses the Cornish Bridge across the Connecticut River, where there's a crowd waiting for him at Wethersfield, where there's a big celebration in Wethersfield. In fact, he was so popular there that almost 100 years later, when an old lady died, the front page of the newspaper showed her and said she was a woman who shook the hand of a hand that shook the hand of Lafayette. I mean, it was that big a deal.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's so great. Now, I know President Washington went on a similar tour, but it was when he first became president, late 18th century, to kind of sell the Constitution and the idea of this new republic to Americans. But this idea of a farewell tour by Lafayette, was that a thing in this time, in the early 19th century when he was here?
I've never heard of it before.
Wow.
I mean, there weren't such things as vacations. And the idea that you could be handed around like a sports star or a celebrity, this was something new. And this guy's riding around in a all white uniform with officer retainers and all white uniforms on very nice horses. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was rock star is as close as you can come to his treatment. And he was soaking it up and stretching it out as long as he could. When he finally got to Vermont, he didn't have a lot of time because he had to get to Lake Champlain, where there was a steamboat ready to take him down to the new Erie Canal and the next leg of his trip. So he was on a schedule. He was always behind. But there were crowds everywhere. And he stayed longer. He was supposed to be there for dinner. He wanted to stay for breakfast, too.
Oh, that's interesting. Historian Willard Stern Randall is with me until 10 to tell us about the Marquis de Lafayette in the United States and in his native France. We're going to pop out for a CBS News update and then pick up the discussion again. If you'd like to jump in with a thought or question, you can call us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, Holiday Ornaments, Cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Our phone number here at WDEV is 244-1777. I'm sure we chose it because 1777 was the year the Marquis de Lafayette arrived in this country and offered his assistance to our army. We're learning all about this French soldier who believed wholeheartedly in the cause of this nascent country. Here to tell us all about Lafayette is Willard Stern Randall, who has written biographies on Ben Franklin, Benedict Arnold, George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and Ethan Allen. Listeners, you can join the discussion. If you've got a question or comment, give us a call at 244-1777. There's that number again, or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Professor Randall, we left off talking about when the Marquis de Lafayette came back to the U.S. for a 13-month farewell tour, and you mentioned it stopped in Vermont. So where in Vermont did he stop during his tour?
Well, he came across from Claremont to Wethersfield, and he there was quite a big welcome there, and they still celebrate that visit there. Then he went up to Woodstock and Barnard, and then up to Castleton, where he stayed at Smith's Tavern. And there's an historical marker to Lafayette there, the only one in the state, so far as I know, to his visit. And then on to Randolph, where he rendezvoused with the governor, Van Ness, and his some members of his court and cabinet, who escorted him from Randolph to Montpelier. They took so long coming along the way. One thing, Lafayette loved animal husbandry. He saw Merino sheep for the first time. Merino sheep were these shaggy, bushy, wonderful sheep, but they were, the King of Spain had the monopoly on them. And somebody from Wethersfield, Vermont, had managed to get a shipment of them. There's Lafayette getting to see the sheep that would actually outnumber people in Vermont.
That's right.
So he would stop and be fascinated by that and talk to people about it. So they got to Montpelier, and he stayed overnight in the pavilion, and he met with Justin Morrill on his way from Randolph, who would become the senator and the land-grant senator and all of that. So he was meeting politicians and future politicians as he came along. In Montpelier, he met with women's groups. He visited with members of the Supreme Court who honored him with speeches. But they were all taking so long that the farmers had gone home to milk their cows, so he didn't get the crowd. He got the dignitaries, but he didn't get the crowd.
That's
and then with Van Ness and company, they rode on to Williston, where they were escorted by, I love this, the Williston Light Horse Cavalry. Williston had its own cavalry in 1825, and they escorted it into Burlington. Now, by now, he's so far behind schedule that he's a little crowded in Burlington. His visit to Burlington lasted 12 hours, but here's what he crowded into it. First, he put the cornerstone in to the new building at UVM because the original building had burned down.
Right.
So it's called South Hall, and the Lafayette building is now inside of that building. You can still find a Lafayette Hall. So he put the cornerstone down, and he met with 60 students, which may have been all the students at UVM at the time. Then they went to a dinner reception at Summit and Main Street at what is now called Grassmount. It's where UVM raises money. And it was the home of Governor Van Ness. So a very fancy reception there. And then down the hill to meet the crowd at what is now City Hall Park. There was a crowd and the band and an official celebration. But he's on the move now because he has to catch the steamboat, the Phoenix, called the Phoenix because Phoenix was this classical image of something that rose from the dead, from the ashes.
Mm-hmm.
And this ship didn't rise from the ashes, but it was replacing the first steamboat on Lake Champlain, which had already sunk.
Uh-huh.
So there's Lafayette and his entourage riding onto the Phoenix and going down Lake Champlain, or up Lake Champlain, sailors would say, to Whitehall. And there they would join, they would link up with the northern spur of the Erie Canal, which had just opened up, the Champlain Canal. So that was his visit. He crowded a lot into the Burlington part of it. And so Burlington has honored him by putting, UVM has put a statue of him near the Ira Allen Chapel on the main campus. He's looking posh there and has a very fancy coat on. It's a statue of him after he came to Vermont, not in uniform anymore. And he went back and this time led that final successful revolution in 1830, and he lasted another 4 years. So a long life for people at that time, living to almost 80.
There's a wonderful tour that you can take of the UVM campus and the buildings, and it's usually in the spring through the summer, maybe into early fall. And you can go to Old Mill and you can see the cornerstone. But I believe the tour guide tells the story of that statue that you mentioned, Professor Randall, originally being in the center of the green. And then when they got a statue of Ira Allen, then I think Lafayette was moved off to the side. I could be wrong if I'm remembering that story, but
no, I'm signing on with that story. Yeah.
Okay.
Ira Allen had become the founding father of the UVM instead of the bankrupt guy who was buried in an unmarked grave in Pennsylvania.
That's right.
So Lafayette was sort of downgraded, and the Allens really took over the founding of UVM.
But
there are other places too that honor him. I think it's not just here. Lafayette Park across from the White House became pretty famous this year because of demonstrations there. There's an equestrian statue of him mounted on a horse right in your line of vision for the White House. There's Lafayette College, you mentioned, in Pennsylvania.
Right.
There's Fayette County, Pennsylvania. There's Fayetteville, North Carolina. Fayetteville, Pennsylvania. Lafayette, Indiana. And one of the stories you can lose track of if you keep it all in the United States is when World War I came, we weren't in it officially, but college boys who had learned to fly joined up with the first American Overseas Air Force called the Lafayette Escadrille. They were a volunteer flying force that flew for the French against the Germans. And when General Pershing led our army over there when we joined World War I, when he got there, the first thing he said was, Lafayette, nous sommes là. Lafayette, we are here. So our entering World War I was payback to help the French because they had helped us in the Revolution.
So he was able to come over here for 13 months and go on this farewell tour. And as I mentioned at the open, there are markers now commemorating his stops on that tour in various places, a couple new ones in New Hampshire. There's a group online promoting the Lafayette Trail, which I think is of this farewell tour. But during this tour, was he just enjoying retirement? Did he have an official role at all?
No, he was enjoying retirement. He had never, they didn't have the notion of retirement. He was a marquis for life. And then from the, after he went back after the American Revolution, he became a field marshal. So, he's a very big man. He's a statesman, et cetera. How he made his living most of the time, I guess he had tenants on land. There was no safety net for these guys if they weren't in public office. So he's sort of a semi-retired hero who's so popular that wherever he goes, people are going to be very honored to have him stay for a while. And President Monroe had him stay for 13 months.
And like we do for sports heroes now on a farewell tour, was he given gifts of any type at different stops?
I really don't know that. That's a darn good question. I'm sure he was. I don't know how he would transport them.
Yeah, that's true.
But it could be. I don't think he got speaker's fees or anything. He just became more and more famous, which eventually got him back into politics in France, and he could be the leader of a successful movement to get rid of the monarchy one more time, although they had kept having to get rid of the monarchy another time.
That's true. Professor Randall, before the break, we were talking about his 13-month farewell tour in the States, and then he heads back to France for another revolution. Tell us about what happens there.
Well, he went back. He had become, first of all, he had turned down an offer to participate in Bonaparte Napoleon's government after the French Revolution. But then the Bourbon kings came back after Napoleon was finally defeated. And so Lafayette joined the Chamber of Deputies, the government, their legislature. He was a liberal member, ahead of the liberal wing there, and he stayed in the Chamber of Deputies for most of the rest of his life. So he had it's like a senator for life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he had an income. But he also had the family estate on the Marne River in the eastern part, the part of France that is now best known for Disney Europe. he's a dignitary. He's in the government. And he accepted the invitation to be the guest of the United States in 1824, visited all 24 states in the Union, and then he went back and stayed in the Chamber of Deputies. And there was another revolution in that's called the July Revolution of 1830, so 5 years after he was here. And he was actually offered, he was offered the head of the French government by the revolutionaries to become a French dictator, which he refused. He supported the return of the monarch briefly, King Louis-Philippe, but when Louis-Philippe just proved to be another autocratic despot, he turned on him again. So for the rest of his life, he remained the liberal figurehead, the spokesman for moderation and opposing the monarchy. He died in 1834, and he's buried in Paris under soil brought over from Bunker Hill, with the first major battle of the American Revolution. So that symbolism goes back and forth, that bond between the countries, even in his death.
You mentioned he turned down the opportunity to become French dictator. And, I mean, he had very strong political views, pretty left-leaning views. And yet he had this opportunity then to lead and to be the person who could put them in action. Any reason why he turned down that opportunity?
Well, I don't think he wanted to become another Napoleon. And the French seemed to, through their history, have seemed to, you know, waver between, you know, autocratic rule and very democratic rule. So you can get revolutions, but they can turn into the Reign of Terror, where one political party devours the next political party, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think he wanted that trend to continue. He was opposed to a strong king, but not enough to permanently overthrow the monarchy. You know, besides, he's part of the aristocracy. And 40,000 French aristocrats had been beheaded in the French Revolution. I'm sure he never forgot that. Mm. An awful lot of friends and relatives among them. So he took up, it's sort of, we would say, a left-of-center stance from that time on. And he's the figure of moderation. And he's working for the rights of men and women. He's an early feminist. He's anti-slavery. He's all for modernization in agriculture, etc. For example, he sends, you know, Washington struggled with this business of slavery all his life, and what Washington needed was some way to cultivate the land without so much human labor. So Lafayette actually got mules from the King of Spain, also proprietary mules bred by the King of Spain, and sent them over. Washington then matched them with horses, and you get the mule. He sends donkeys to mate with horses, and you get the mule, and Southern agriculture takes off from that time, 40 acres in the plow by the time of the Civil War. So these people are experimenting with a new way of life in agriculture as well as government. It's a period of great change, and Lafayette lives long enough and rolls with the punches enough to stay out in front of it.
I think of someone like Seth Warner of the Green Mountain Boys. Seems like they're this integral part to the efforts of the time, but their place in history has kind of lost a little luster, and it seems that's the same with Lafayette. Is there a connection a parallel there between those two?
I think so. We you know, the rock star thing still holds up because our presidents are supposed to be rock stars. They're supposed to be perfect. They're supposed to do all sorts of things, accomplish things right in a hopeless job in a very short period of time.
Right.
So we elevate them and we forget not the vice president, but everybody under them that was part of the contribution, part of the movement. So there's this sort of second tier of important figures. Ethan Allen gets the play in Vermont because he's flamboyant, and he writes his own history, his narrative, and he's the one that captures the fort. But you forget that there were, you know, 82 other guys with him.
Right.
And you forget that he was a disaster after that first attack and blew it in Montreal. And Seth Warner comes along, and he's not flashy, but Seth Warner's the guy who shows up in the key battle at Bennington. So we have more heroes than we have stars. And part of what I'm trying to do is to shine the light on them, too.
Yeah. I know you give talks on the Marquis de Lafayette. Have you considered writing a book about him?
I've considered it. I haven't considered it with my editor yet. I've just finished a new book that will be out this year called The Founders' Fortunes, How Money Shaped the Birth of America. And a lot of these figures are in that book. And once that goes off to press, then I'll sit down and talk to the editor about what comes next.
All right. Once that comes out, I hope you'll come back and join us again for that.
Of course I will. You know, I really like WDEV. I sat across from Mark Johnson for many years doing broadcasts, and I like WDEV, and I like its audience very much, so it's always a pleasure.
Great. Now, I just want to ask about, you know, we think of him here, I think he's still thought of in the U.S. very highly, the Marquis de Lafayette, but his record in France, you know, it seems a little spotty. You know, he's supporting the monarchy, against the monarchy. So how is he viewed in his home country of France?
I'm sure he's in their pantheon, but he's not considered so important because he was too moderate when the revolution came along, the French Revolution. So he's in the first round, the Constituent Assembly, which would look just exactly like the Congress of the United States, but he wasn't considered radical enough. So the radicals are more remembered than the middleman, the hinge. I mean, he is the one, after all, the fall of the Bastille, that hated dungeon at the beginning of the French Revolutionary War. He's the man that made it possible. But then you have people come along after him who are they want to take it to the next extreme. So they break up all the statues. They execute a lot of people. The Reign of Terror is unimaginable. There's a library for the French Foreign Ministry that I've gone to, and on one very long high wall there are 40,000 black binders. Each one is for one of the aristocrats of their families who were executed. They had five guillotines going simultaneously. The whole family of executioners in Paris who ran out of time, so they just wrote how many each day in their diary. Out on the coast of France, they put aristocrats on rafts and then sank the rafts. I mean, we can't imagine what that kind of terror is like any time before, maybe Cambodia in the late 20th century. Mm. But he didn't want extremes. He was trying to be moderate. And France either wanted, it seems, radical revolution or the old ancien regime with all the pomp and circumstance and all the control of all the power and money. And he was trying to steer a middle road. So the hardest lane to drive in is the middle lane.
Yeah.
You get hit from either side.
Willard Stern Randall is a professor emeritus of history at Champlain College. Professor Randall, I want to thank you for this wonderful hour of history. You really brought it to life. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rick.
CBS News is next, and we'll be back to learn about a Vermont craft brewed non-alcoholic IPA. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, Holiday Ornaments, Cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Non-alcoholic beers. I know. Nothing to get excited about, because the flavor just doesn't come close to your regular brews. It's just the kind of challenge a group of Vermonters loves. We can brew the best beers in the world here. Why can't we figure out how to do the same with the non-alcoholic version? And hence, Rescue Club Brewing was born. Joining us now is their director of sales and co-founder, Chris Nelson. Chris, great to have you on Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. It's so good to be here.
Excellent. And listeners, if you've got questions about this new NA brew, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Chris, describe what you're brewing at Rescue Club.
Well, what we're brewing is an IPA, our version of a non-alcoholic IPA, which is really exciting.
Why call it Rescue Club? Although, RC, my initials, but why is it called Rescue Club?
Yeah. Well, I didn't think you were actually going to pick up on that one, Rick, but nothing gets past you. We were going to just call it Rick St. Gary Brewing Company.
Thank you.
But, you know, we didn't want to embarrass you or anything like that.
And the rights and everything
else,
yeah.
Rescue Club, I mean, they're two beautiful words together. There's also a meaning, there's a club in golf, when you play golf, one of the clubs that you can use is called the Rescue Club. It's a hybrid, mm-hmm. which uses iron, it's an iron and a wood, and gets you out of sticky situations. And I think we like that idea of getting you out of sticky situations a little bit. It's really just, you know, nice to think that there's something out there that you can reach for that's going to help you kind of, achieve your goal, get to where you want to get, and while still giving you, the things and the flavor that you love about beer.
Where are you brewing Rescue Club?
So Rescue Club is brewed at Zero Gravity. We're actually, part of Zero Gravity. I would say we're kind of like under the umbrella of Zero Gravity. But we're enjoying, treating this, taking this whole thing, because it's so different from everything else that Zero Gravity does, that we're really treating it like a brand new brand. We're giving it the focus that it deserves as, one would give a startup, I'd say.
Who else is involved in Rescue Club?
Oh, it's just me, Rick. Just me alone. I just show up and people wonder what I'm doing in the brewery. And
I'm very impressed.
It's crazy that I can get away with it. So the whole, really, it's hard to not be involved with it if you're at Zero Gravity.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, top down, it's myself and Matt Wilson and the brew team. It's the brewers at Zero Gravity are very involved. They're the ones, making it. I am not a brewer, but I've worked closely with these guys to achieve what we're going for. And we're, all headed for the same place. We're all looking for the same goal and we're doing it together.
Where did the idea for this non-alcoholic IPA come from?
So, when we decided that we were going to invent the concept, no, I'm just kidding. The idea really came from some folks at Zero Gravity. These are people I've been friends with for a long time. And it was presented to me as this, hey, we're actually thinking about, going for this and seeing what we could do. And, once I heard that, there was a possibility that we could make a beer that was remotely close to, the IPAs of Vermont that I love, I was like, huh, this sounds intriguing. So, it came from them and at some point, after kind of mulling it over in my head for a while, I decided to, if I could get involved, I would. And they, they asked me if I wanted to be involved, and I said yes. And so here I am.
Now, a Vermont IPA, the bar is very high. You could have chose something else. So why did you try to emulate an IPA?
Well, you know, I there's a lot of really, you know, very good non-alcoholic beers made in Germany, I believe, that are in the kind of Hefeweizen or Weiss beer category. There's also some really great lagers being made. And in this country also, if, you know, the lager has been kind of beat over the head with you know, the big macro companies trying to make a great, you know, alternative to Budweiser, basically, for forever. I don't even, it's they've been doing it since before, you know, during Prohibition, I bet, is when this actually, you know, first came up. So what we really wanted to do was, you know, do something different, do something, you know, it's, it, and also something that we love to drink. I mean, I not that I don't love lagers. Don't get me wrong. I drink plenty of lager, plenty of Green State lager, plenty of, you know, all the different great lagers that are out there. But to have, you know, it's kind of like the white whale. It's like we're searching for this, you know, unknown, unfound thing that you know, people have seen glimpses of, but no one's ever really caught it. So that's why we went for IPA. And honestly, it's the challenge with IPA is the aromatics, yeah, and the flavor of the hops. It's really difficult to you know, have that extraction of flavor from hops without having alcohol in there. So, you know, that's been the particular challenge, and I feel like we've addressed it pretty successfully.
IPA lovers always want to know what hops are in there. Which hops are you using? So what did you use in Rescue Club?
So we've got Matueca and Citra. Matueca, I'm not sure if you're familiar. It's a New Zealand hop. And then Citra is, you know, been one of the more, you know, relatively popular hops, mm-hmm, in the last, you know, couple of years, I'd say. So the way those hops work, and then with the grain build of the beer, it actually comes together and, you know, presents a really lovely hop characteristic.
What makes this different from these other NA beers, which have been on the market for decades now?
Well, again, you know, those other beers have provided a some place for people to go, right? There's clearly over decades been a demand. I think probably a slow growing demand. And it's not until recently that, for health reasons, for just, you know, the humans are evolving, our tastes, our brains are evolving, and we're looking for something new and something that's more true to where our flavor palette is today. And, you know, I'm not sure when the last time you had one of those other beers, but they're quite unremarkable.
I hate to group them
all together. I mean, it's not really fair. I know we don't have, you know, I'd love to go back and forth and compare how much better our non-op is to all the others. Mm-hmm. we're just going to have to group them all together and just, you know, say that ours is just significantly better.
So what is the process?
Well, we'll
accept that for an answer and give people the opportunity to try it. We'll talk about the rollout soon. But what's the process that you're using that makes this a more flavorful non-alcoholic beer?
So we take we make beer. There's a recipe that's been built, and then we actually create a full beer. Then we have a proprietary method where we extract the alcohol in a way that's more gentle to the beer. So what we're doing is by pulling it out in this gentle manner, it's a slow, tedious, gentle manner, we actually are able to preserve a lot of the aromatics and the thing, the volatiles that like pop off very easily. So by doing that, we retain some of the great flavor, and then we do another hop addition at the end.
using the word proprietary means that you're not going to tell me everything about this method, but also using the word gentle, I get the feeling like you do with plants, you're actually speaking to the alcohol and getting it to remove itself from the beer you brewed. Am I close?
Yeah, it's something like that, yeah. You know, kind of like herding cats.
Yes,
you
know. I'm sure it is.
Come on, alcohol. You get over there now.
Well, I'm glad you're whispering to your beer and getting it done. Now, this took a while to launch. I believe you had hoped to roll it out in the spring. You just launched it on Saturday, as I mentioned. So why the delay?
Well, you know, there are a few things. I don't know if you guys are aware, but there's a pandemic going on.
Oh, that.
I didn't want to break that news to everybody this morning, but it's true.
Well, we try to break news here every once in a while.
Not to get off topic, and I'll answer the question. How do you even keep up? How do you even have time for a story like me when there's like absurdly crazy news going on constantly? It's like. Anyway, I'm sorry. You can either answer that or not, or maybe I should get back to my answer.
You probably should.
there are some things that came up that some we were ready for and some we weren't. And when COVID kicked in, it made everything much harder to deal with. So, for example, if there was a mechanical problem or you know, just a part that we might have needed. Everything just came to a screeching halt. And, you know, we didn't know, you know, what, you know, how long it would take for us to put together some of these aspects. And then there was the fear of like, oh my God, you know, we're about to launch during this pandemic. Is that even, you know, does that make any sense at all? Just all the unknowns that everybody was experiencing. And also, miraculously, during this time, Zero Gravity was able to acquire the brewery where Magic Hat formerly was made.
Right.
At Bartlett Bay. So, you know, that was a pretty big undertaking as a business in general to take on another facility that was just, you know, more than doubling Zero Gravity's like space was a big undertaking. So Rescue Club, because of the pandemic and that and all these, you know, complications, it just took a backseat for a little while. And we were able to fine tune it over that time after some of our parts came in and some of our, you know, after we figured out, you know, some of the things that we couldn't figure out. It actually gave us some time to come up with or to really make it the best product that we think we could make.
You mentioned taking over the old Magic Hat Brewery in South Burlington. How is that move progressing for Zero Gravity right now?
You know, from my perspective, my understanding, I think it's been great. You know, I think one of the challenges with this time is that it's, you know, it's very hard to have very much integration between the two places. Mm. I think some people have, you know, gone to one facility and some people have come to the other, you know, some people have gone from Pine to Bartlett Bay and vice versa. But for the most part, I think the idea has been to keep them relatively isolated and separate because, you know, if there was an outbreak at one, then, you know, you hopefully, you know, it can be contained.
Right.
Luckily, thank God, we haven't had to deal with any of those issues. And the only reason I say that is it's hard to really mix. You know, the company, I think beer companies in general, but Beer Gravity is very much a really like highly functioning family, and people. You know, it's super social. And everybody's incredibly positive. So I think it's going really well. That said, it's just, there hasn't been like a big get together between the two facilities, if that answers the question.
This isn't your first launch. You were one of the three founders of Citizen Cider, and in the spirit of full disclosure, I have to mention that there is a cider that they produce that is named after me. But how much has Citizen grown from that first year when you produced about 4,000 gallons of hard cider?
Oh, Rick. Tremendously. It's been just about 10 years here, and Citizen Cider has become one of the certainly a marker of quality and consistency. It's a highly respected, amazing cider, and it's throughout the Northeast. Goes pretty far south down into North Carolina. I'm not even sure if other states have opened up since I've left. However, I know that they're continuing to do really well and continuing to produce more and to produce more better. And, I think things are going really, really well. My focus has been, when I left my day to day at Citizen, I kind of keep track of what's going on with where I can, but I'm impacting, very little there at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know the details, but I do know that, things are going very well and we have continued to grow, pretty well.
I'll get back to Rescue Club, which is the new NAIPA that you're working on now. So the launch was Saturday. Where and when will people find it?
So currently it's available at Zero Gravity's tap room on Pine Street, 716 Pine. They're open 12 to 8 every day. There's a walk-up window. If you haven't done it yet, I feel like they've kind of nailed how to COVID, how to eat out and drink a little bit during COVID, I guess, is what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really nice outdoor area with heaters, so it's reasonable to stay outside and have a pint or some of Frank's food from Great Northern or a Rescue Club. So that's where it is currently. And as of the 18th, we'll be launching with Feral Distributing throughout the state. So I would say, expect seeing it in some of your local stores. We're a little ways off from launching in some of the bigger places, some of the chains, some of the, chain grocery and chain, convenience type stores. But all of your favorite spots where you go to get, your local craft beers, we'll be there. We'll be there as soon as we possibly can. And Farrell will be delivering it.
To do a launch like this, how many cases do you have to produce before you can say, okay, now we're ready to sell our first one, right? You can't just say, okay, it's off the line and let's start selling it to people. So how much do you have to kind of build up an inventory before you have an actual launch of a product like this?
That is such a great question, Rick, because, one of the things about Zero Gravity, if they're going to do a one-off, right? If they're doing like a, some sort of double IPA,
sure.
or whatever, a flavor, that they seems like they come up with fun new styles all the time, or not new styles, but new brands. They have a marker for what they're going to do, and they get it out there and they sell it out. They probably pre-sell a little bit and figure out how much they're going to need. With this, we're somewhat limited by our capacity of how much, how fast we can make more. Because we essentially take beer and then you add on days to the process.
Mm.
So we're talking about adding on 3 days at least to finish the beer. So what that does is it makes it challenging to increase dramatically. So what we are doing is we're launching with our batch sizes that we can do currently. And we'll make as much as we can. So we're doing basically 300 cases at a time. And when we do a batch, that's how we're going to launch. So it's not going to be tons of quantity up front, but enough to get out there. And, as we grow and, we'll be able to increase that. But then again, it's like, who knows? This could be the greatest IPA non-alcoholic beer in the world. Getting it out to people during a pandemic when there's no restaurants, there's no bars, there's no places for people to sample. It's really hard to know.
Yeah.
Exactly. What the demand will be like. So, this is the interesting, fun, challenge and puzzle of how to launch a brand during a time like this. I don't know if I said this to you, the other day, but it's like, I'll let you know, when the pandemic's over, how we did.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that could be the case for all things. And will people be able to get it sent out to people out of state if they, it will be some kind of, mail order set up, through Zero Gravity?
Yeah, so it's all going to be through Rescue Club. Like, we have our own website, rescueclub.com. We have Instagram. We've got Facebook. And, I think we have the Twitter now. Not sure if we started TikTok yet, Rick. So,
I shiver with anticipation.
That's your big social. But
yes.
The answer is yes. From our website, we'll have an online store where you can have it shipped to wherever you are. We'll have it around the nation, but again, we're limited on supply and we want to make sure that we're getting our local people the non-alcoholic beer that they need.
Chris Nelson is a co-founder and director of sales for Rescue Club Brewing, makers of a new non-alcoholic craft IPA. I just love saying that. Chris, I want to thank you for telling us all about it this morning.
Hey, I appreciate it so much. It's such a pleasure. I've always wanted to be on the Howard Stern Show. So, this is finally a dream come true for me.
Yes.
But in all seriousness, Rick, thank you very much. And, look forward to seeing all of you. And, please come down and grab some Rescue Club.
Sounds good. We're going to take a break and then we'll hear about a group called Be the Change that's looking to protect our pollinators. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. My next guest is going to tell you some dark truths, probably some things you're not going to want to hear. But don't resent him for the message he's delivering. Instead, stay with him as he also explains what we can do to come back from that dark place. We're going to discuss pollinators, why we need them, why we're losing them, and what we can do to help them. Mike Kiernan is a native beekeeper. He's with the group called Be the Change. Mike, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. It's great to be here. Thank you for having us.
And listeners, if you've got a question about the plight of pollinators, give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. If you're doing something to help pollinators, you can call us or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mike, start us off by telling us what B, and that's B-E-E, Be the Change is.
I appreciate the fact that it is a little bit of a a dark story to talk about another problem. We have so many problems right now that we're facing in our world. And it's like our control panel is all lit up with flashing red lights of things we need to be concerned about. And then we get a virus.
Right.
It's really an amazing time. But it's also a time where I think you can see through the smoke of all of this, some opportunities that are being realized. And I think that we are, as a species, we do tend to get things eventually. You know, it takes time sometimes. But if you looked at Phoenix, Arizona in 1970, 80% of what was around their houses was lawn. And now it's 5%. So the fact is we make progress. We understand things and we change. And we think we're not change adaptable, but we are. And so, yes, I would like to talk about a problem and an important problem. And the context, you know, there was a series of important UN documents that brought climate change to our awareness. And then a bunch of people like Bill McKibben, who's going to be on at 1 o'clock, who were instrumental in our understanding that there was a problem that needed to be addressed. And now we see in the landscape these solutions out there like renewable energy sources. And this is something where, you know, as Vermonters, we collectively own what the landscape looks like. And not everybody loves to look at these solar panels. But when I see them, I feel a kind of optimism. We're not necessarily going to warm the earth to the point where we can't survive. Look at what we're doing there. And it's opportunity space as well. That's where we look at it, as a space of opportunity, where it was a working landscape. Maybe it had cows or sheep grazing on it. Some people do have sheep grazing in their pollinators, in their solar fields. But we look at a solar field as an opportunity to create pollinator habitat.
Well, let's focus a little bit on the problem that you've identified, Be the Change has identified.
So this is something where the UN panel on diversity, biodiversity, put out two reports, one in 2018, one in 2019, that spoke about species loss, about our biodiversity and how important it is, and species loss as a problem equal to climate change in importance in terms of whether it needs to be addressed, and called for whole-scale policy change across all levels of government. And I think we have so many things going on right now, it hasn't reached that sort of public consciousness. But we are looking at the pollinators as a specific group of species. And it's not just the bee, which is the honeybee, which is an important pollinator, but the several hundred species of bees we have, and the butterflies, moths, hummingbirds, other pollinators that play an essential role for moving pollen from plant to plant that allows plants to reproduce. So if we're going to have a strawberry, it takes several hundred visits from a pollinator for that strawberry to grow. And if you look at a field where you see blunted little strawberries, it's not that there was a disease. It's more likely they didn't get pollinated enough. So the pollinators play this kind of invisible role. They're not entirely invisible, but they're kind of happening in the background of our lives, of creating all the fruits and vegetables that we eat, all the parts of our diet that are not carbohydrate-based, all the micronutrients and vitamins and vegetables. Those things are mostly pollinator-dependent, in addition to a lot of other things we love, like coffee and chocolate, pollinator-dependent plants. And so the decline in pollinators has been happening kind of invisibly. And so we have 17 bumblebee species in our state here in Vermont. 5 years ago, we had all 17 species. Now we're down to 10. And of those 7 that are endangered, 4 of them are gone. It doesn't matter what you build for habitat. They're not coming back. But in our fields where we establish pollinator habitat, I have one field where I've seen 5 different species of bumblebees in that field. And there's no other spot in Vermont where I've seen that many species in one place. So if they are there and you create habitat for them, they come back in numbers. And that's the most fun thing about this, is to see a field that would have been just turf grass or stone or something that the solar folks have to control so it doesn't shade the panels, now becoming a habitat that's restoring a very important part of our species that will be this, you know, the nearby landowners can see apple trees that are producing like they never have before. And we have 2 farms where that farmer said, "We've never seen apples like this since I was a kid," you know, and this is a farmer in his 50s. Mm-hmm. And that's because of the decline of pollinators since the 1970s that is now being reversed by creating these habitats.
Well, Mike, explain to people exactly what Be the Change is doing to make sure that we have pollinators here in our state and our region.
Great. So thank you for clarifying me and pointing me so I'm making the story clear because okay. It's a little complex.
It is.
But there are solar fields going in all around us. And what we do is work with the solar developer. Generally, this is a solar developer that's hiring us. And we will create a pollinator habitat in that solar field. So that means there will be something blooming throughout the three parts of our season, the early part, that mid part where things get pretty dry, and then that end part where we see the asters and the goldenrod and all those things. Throughout the season in that field and in the area just surrounding the fence line, there will be a pollinator habitat. It will be plantings that we put in there that will be nourishing to pollinators. And so we also have to think about their shelter needs in addition to the things that sustain them. But we're creating something that's looking at the diversity of plantings. The plantings reflects the diversity of pollinators we want to help out. So each of the fields we've been engaged in becomes a little area where pollinators are being nourished. And so we started that, this is now 6 years ago, and now we're in almost 25 fields and have created a habitat equivalent to every Vermont household doing a 6x6 pollinator garden. But they should, too. Every household creating a little habitat will be nourishing for them as well. And that's what you get to see them. You see the increase in visitors. And you think, do we always have this many bees and butterflies? You know?
I do love on your website, the one thing that's really important is, and you just mentioned the way you need to do this is to provide the pollinators with the plants that bloom at different times throughout the summer so that they can continue to pollinate throughout that span of time, correct?
Yes, the problem with a monoculture, like even you look at the almond groves in California, they're in beautiful bloom for 3 weeks, and there's almost 1 million acres of almonds in California. And you see that field in bloom, and it looks beautiful because we like to see our apple orchards in bloom. But if you only have almonds growing, there's nothing else for them. So they have no pollinators left in California to take care of these almonds. And so they're trucking in honeybees because that's the only way they can get the almonds pollinated. That's harder and harder to do because of the diseases that honeybees are facing. So all over the nation, they're trucking bees to California for a couple of weeks. So that monoculture, which is the way large agricultural spaces are used, is the problem. And so here we have this space, which is generally right next to a bunch of other agricultural spaces, which is highly diverse. And so there's something blooming in May, blooming in June, blooming even in July when things get sort of drier out, and then, as I said, later on those end-of-season plants that we know and love.
How does that almond field in California and the use of the bee population there affect us here and our pollinators in Vermont?
And the problem is, you imagine putting a beehive on a truck, and I've moved honeybees around. It's really not, they don't want to be moved, but if you look at those two large boxes and call that a hive, that's about 50,000 bees in that. And you can put six of them on a pallet and stack the pallets pretty high, put about 400 of them on a semi-truck. So that's a lot of bees moving across the country, stopped when the truck stops, getting overheated, all that kind of thing. It's hard for them to survive that journey. But because there's 1 million acres of almonds, they need 2 hives per acre. That's 2 million hives moving across the country and then coming back to wherever they come from. And that is a way of spreading diseases. The folks at UVM at the Gundt Institute have done some research that shows that diseases can be spread in that fashion. That's one of the reasons the honeybee, that management practice, is one of the reasons the honeybees are seeing so many different diseases, one after another. And there's yet more coming from the different parts of the world where we can see them following the path that the other diseases have that we then spread around the country again because we're moving bees. They don't hibernate together, but that's how the white-nosed bat disease happens because the bats hibernate together. So the unnatural practice of moving bees all to one spot, there's only 3 million beehives in the nation. So 2 million of them are going to California every spring, and then distributing back around the country, it spreads diseases.
Mike, introduce us to the pollinators we have here in our area.
So it's a beautiful and diverse area where there are over 200 native bee species. And the honeybee actually is not one of them. The honeybee is an import from Europe, came with us, that is a very important pollinator because you can move it around, as I said. But the native bees are mostly more efficient pollinators. So, for example, the orchard mason bee, which is what is allowed, it comes out early about the time of the apple blossoms, is more effective than 100 honeybees at pollinating apple trees. And so it's a cavity nesting bee. So there's those that rest that make their homes in the ground, which is most of them, and the others that make their homes in tubes of plants or holes that a beetle has drilled. The cavity nesting bees and the ground nesting bees. In addition, we have butterflies, which we think of, as pollinators. We can bring to mind pretty easily the monarch butterfly, and it's another one of the ambassador species for understanding the importance of pollinators and their decline is the story of the monarch. And then there's many more. There's maybe 105 or so butterfly species, and there's 1,200 moth species. And then actually flies are very important pollinators. In addition to all the important things that flies do for degrading nutrients and that kind of thing, there's a way that flies can be important pollinators. Hummingbirds are an important pollinator for some plants. So there's a diverse group of species, and is supporting the diversity of them is the part of this that's most important, because you really can't underestimate the importance of pollinators, because once they're gone, they don't come back. They don't re-arise after they're gone. And so there's been a decline in a relatively short period of time, and that's what we need to stop the decline and try and turn around.
Ted is calling us from Shelburne. Let's go to the phones. Ted, thanks so much for calling Vermont Viewpoint. Go right ahead.
Well, okay, good. I wanted to point out part of what we can do is, one is look at the Facebook page, and if we have farmers markets again, I used to meet this organization at the Shelburne Farmers Market when people could interact in such a way. Right. But anyhow, there's varieties of honeys and various other things that one can see in addition to, part of our direct part of it. But the vital scientific information that you're talking about is also very much most important. So thank you very much.
Thanks,
goodbye.
Ted. Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Sorry, Ted. We look forward to being back at the Shelburne Farmers Market and seeing you there. And we now have a field in Shelburne right next to the Shelburne Museum. It's on museum grounds. And so it's going to be an opportunity to tell the story by having people visit the field as well.
Now, he's talking about some of the products that you have. How does that support the pollinators?
It's one of those – it actually does two things. It helps us – support us in the work, but it also tells the story. So I'll give an example. We have a neck warmer that we just introduced this season, that's insulated with milkweed floss. And so milkweed, we have all seen the pods when they bust open late in the fall, and then the seed flies off on that milkweed floss. That floss you can take and insulate clothing with. In fact, it's an ancient form of insulation, and it's just a return to something old, but it's equivalent to down in terms of its insulating qualities, but it's less allergenic and it's not cruel. And we put the seeds, because I've got a whole lot of separating the floss gives me a whole lot of seeds, we put those in pots and get them started and get them in the ground. And so it's a way of propagating the plant, but also taking some of the plant and making a product that tells the story. Because it's when someone holds that or gets warmed by it, there's a sense that everything we consume is some sort of compromise where it must be harming something somewhere. My cup of coffee, where did this actually come from? What's the cost of this? And so creating a product so that the customer's experience of enjoying it it's actually nurturing in more than just the way it's, the honey is good for you to eat and delicious, but it's actually healing something at a further distance, you know?
Yep. So there is a company in Quebec. I'll have to see if they're still going, but they were using milkweed to line jackets. They were looking at other uses for it.
Right.
I'll have to find that information. I do want to talk about something you mentioned very early on about lawns and how the percentage of area in Phoenix has diminished from so much percent of lawns to a much lower percent. I'm not sure people understand that role, that connection between their grass, lawns, and pollinators. So tell us about that, Mike.
Well, you know, Rick, we have lawns in our houses, and it's a very attractive thing, but it's interesting
that
it's attractive to us. It has language, like, look at this college campus. Look at all that expanse of lawn. And in many cases, it's a monoculture, and it's a wasteland for pollinators. And so what we would love to see as an aesthetic developer, instead of pridefully having lawn, we're thinking, why in the world do we have this lawn? Because your municipal spaces, your schools that have lawn, that acre of lawn is probably going to cost you $1,000 a year to mow and the machinery and the labor to mow it, and that's not carbon neutral. You know, this is where if we could create an aesthetic where we look at lawn and think, why is that lawn? Why could we not create a portion of that that's pollinator habitat with a nice lawn path through it so you can enjoy your walk and not have to worry about ticks or whatever? But that the rest of it is something that's nurturing other species, because once you get into this and you start seeing the species, and every year I get four or five more species that I can identify on the wing. I'm working with scientists who are deeply knowledgeable on this, but for me, it's a learning journey. Once you get into that, you start seeing the world in a whole different way, and imagine how lovely it would be to be walking on a path through a pollinator habitat instead of looking at your expansive lawn that you have to mow all afternoon on your one free day of the week.
So what kind of things do we want to be growing to eliminate some of that lawn and to help the pollinators?
You know, there are a bunch of sources of wildflower seeds, but one that's local and a fantastic company is American Meadows. Mm-hmm. And they make a pollinator mix that's perfect for our region. And they're based in South Burlington or Shelburne. I think it's in South Burlington. But they are, make a mix that's perfect for our region. And if you just took a portion of your lawn and you wanted to make it a small pollinator habitat, that could be done very easily. There's a couple different approaches, but one of them is just to put a tarp down for the season, really closely adhering it to the ground. And then in August, pull that tarp up and put some crimson clover or some other cover crop that'll fill in for the fall, and the following spring, just put a wildflower mix down, and you'll have a pollinator habitat.
Mm.
Do the tarp and do another section.
We're almost out of time, Mike, but how far geographically have the efforts of Be the Change reached so far?
So we're from up at the Canadian border down to Connecticut, Rhode Island, but almost all of our fields are in Vermont. Yeah, I'm based here in Middlebury and Weybridge, actually. My wife and daughter are the principal partners in this effort. And so this is something where we are really pretty local, but we've traveled as far as Missouri and consulted on fields around the country. Mm. But we're mostly right here in the Champlain Valley.
Mike Kiernan is a native beekeeper and co-founder of Be the Change. To learn more about their work, you can visit bethechangehoney.com. Mike, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it.
Take care. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and directed by Danny McIvergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. Coming up next, it's Bill Sayre with Common Sense Radio here on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.